Day to day, we can shy away from conversations about potentially provocative matters like faith, spirituality, and religion. Or sometimes we engage in conversations about those matters in too high a volume. Asma Barlas, a professor of politics at Ithaca College, tries to have her students discuss these matters often. She was recently a visiting scholar at the University of Arkansas and delivered the talk, Sex and Scripture: What Can the Quran Tell Us About Gender Equality? When she came to the Carver Center for Public Radio during that visit, we discussed her topic, but also how to approach conversations about such topics. She says in her classrooms, she often begins with the very basics.
Most of the students have not been really socialized into or brought up as religious people. And so for them, even wrapping their head around scripture is already a stretch. Sex and gender, yes. Scripture, no. So curiously, the harder thing is to get them to understand the significance of scripture in the lives of people who are believers, whether they are Jews or Christians or Muslims. And that's a struggle.
I imagine then there's also, you have to make that connection with words that are, if not ancient, very old.
Yes, and then you have to make that connection in translation. And so then we get to speaking about what's, quote, lost in translation, obviously. But I think more importantly, they are curious about the fact that growing up, they don't have to read a primer about what to think about sex or gender or equality. I mean, those are things they read from different sources and in different contexts. Whereas for a lot of Muslims, though, they don't read the Quran because the vast majority can't read. They're not literate. Ideas about what constitutes a good Muslim woman or an appropriate Muslim man, they are very religiously derived, even though the religion is infused with culture. So I also do want to make it clear that just because you're a Muslim doesn't necessarily mean that you're practicing everything that the Quran teaches, you know? I mean, we are inflected by everything, culture, history, politics. So,
well, I think that would have, you know, I think Christians in the Bible,
yes,
Jewish people in the Torah, I mean, that,
yes,
that's going to be the same for...
Yes, but I think curiously, while Jewish and Christian people are allowed to have a history, to have a culture, but with Muslims, I have a feeling that we seem to have only a religious identity and nothing more, as if we live in, you know, sort of a political vacuum and there's nothing else, you know, shaping our sense of self. And I think it's a sort of a very essentialist view of Muslims as just being religious people. So,
do you mean that that is a view that those of us who are not Muslim,
yes,
have placed upon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That somehow they feel like, you know, I often joke with them, like if you were to follow me around the whole day and observe everything I did or said, and then you came back and said, well, now I know Islam, that would just not be right. That you can't do that. You can't extrapolate from individuals' experiences to what the religions teach. But I think there's still this grand mystery about who Muslims are. Or rather, maybe there's not a mystery. It's a sort of a, what I call a politics of misrecognition. Mm. So it's sort of deeper than that.
And intentional.
I think it's cultivated because I find it very fascinating that medieval Europeans, when they initially encountered Muslims in Spain, when the Muslims conquered parts of Spain, that they viewed Islam as a Christian heresy. And they thought that the Prophet Muhammad was the Antichrist. And so that sort of view of Islam as sort of dangerous and fearful has persisted over the centuries. So I was struck by how in the Danish cartoons, the Prophet is presented as a terrorist. And Islam today is just associated sort of exceptionally with violence. And so it seems to me like very little has changed in 1400 years. It's just that, of course, the Prophet is no longer the Antichrist. He's been secularized. So now he appears in the guise of a terrorist. But in both of these sort of roles, he plays basically the same ideological function vis-a-vis the West as a source of threat.
If not much has changed of a majority of outsiders' views of Islam in 1400 years, is that frustrating? Is that depressing?
It's frustrating, it's depressing, it's mystifying because, you know, I mean, Islam is also an Abrahamic religion. Mm-hmm. And we are in the United States of America, which in spite of being secular, there's a deep Christian foundation here. And so, you know, some scholars of religion have talked about how Muslims and Jews and Christians have lived in intertwined worlds. But while I think our connections with each other are sort of not visible to most people, even as Islam and Muslims are hyper-visible. So it's both sort of being hyper-visible and also being sort of invisibilized. And so it's a real challenge to speak about Islam here.
All right. I want to get back to that, but talking about gender equality, is gender equality addressed in fashion in the Quran?
You know, the Quran isn't a feminist text, and so it's not going to be using terms like gender equality.
Right.
So the point, though, is that when we read it from our contemporary sight in the present, how do we read it? What do we read it to be saying? And when I speak about equality in the Quran, it's because of some of its foundational teachings. And I'll mention only three, which are at the core of the scripture. One is that God created both women and men from the same self. So there is no narrative that the woman was created after the man or from his body and is derivative and is secondary. So, in fact, the Quran says, and I quote here, "We created you out of a single self and made you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another, not that you should despise each other." So it's a very radical view of the oneness of humanity, that every single living being emerged out of this one self. So there's no differentiation between women and men there. The second thing is that the Quran speaks about human vice regency on earth. It's like, you know, human beings are custodians of the earth, and it calls them Khalifa. And it applies the same term to women and men. And lastly, there is a verse there which says that the believing men and believing women are awliya of one another, who enjoin what is right and forbid what is wrong. And awliya is a word, Arabic word, which can mean custodians, guardians, guides, and friends. So from such teachings, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility or reason to say that at its core, it's a very egalitarian text in that it doesn't think that sex and gender are important in defining moral individuality. So in this case, I think actually the absence of sex and gender are very radical. And also it teaches that the Quran teaches that God is uncreated and unlike anything in creation. And if God is unlike anything in creation, then surely God is beyond sex and gender. And the Quran explicitly forbids Muslims from calling God father. So also in refusing to sexualize and engender the divine, I think there are liberatory possibilities, because feminists have long sort of argued that when we present God as male, that men derive authority from that over women. So those are some of the reasons I, you know, sort of see equality in the Quran.
I think there are going to be a lot of people hearing our conversation that have never heard those three things. Again, we've got a majority non-Muslim population here, but you're right, that is very egalitarian.
It is. But you see, Muslims haven't heard those things either, so it's not just the non-Muslims. I think what's probably the most frustrating thing to me as an observant Muslim is that there are about less than half a dozen passages in the Quran, and they're not even full passages. In some cases, they're just single lines, and in a few cases, solitary words. And those are the words and verses that some Muslims read as, you know, giving men certain rights that the Quran doesn't give to women. And based on that, they ignore everything else the Quran has to say. And there are over 6,000 verses in the Quran. So the way to put this mathematically would be to say that 0.01% of the text has become the basis for Muslim laws and is at the core of the Muslim imaginary in when they talk about things like women's rights. So it's not just that people here haven't read it. It's that Muslims also have their few favorite verses, which they will throw at you. to make a point, especially if they want to justify violence against women.
I was going to say, it sounds as if it's a power move.
Completely. But then, you know, patriarchy is older than Islam. It's it predates Christianity and Judaism. Although feminists always talk about these masculinist religions, the truth is that patriarchy is a very ancient institution. And when you have religions revealed into patriarchies, then you can be sure as heck that the people who are going to interpret them, and they're usually men, and that they're going to be interpreting them in ways that don't undermine their own rights. And one of those rights is authority over women. Men derive their, it seems, sense of self in the world from being able to exercise authority.
As you see young people come through your classroom, are you optimistic that there can be some chipping away of the patriarchy? Do you see a difference in students now than you might have, you know, years or decades earlier?
I'm of two minds about that. On the one hand, I think change can't come until people actually start to shift and change, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I'm not a liberal in the sense that I think, oh, if enough people think the right thoughts, we can change the world. The world got to be the way it is through structures. Structures include capitalism, racism, sexism. They include hundreds of years of a certain sedimented institutionalization of these biases. And so I think there is a structural logic there. And patriarchy is very deeply entrenched. So I have to share with you the fact that when this whole Me Too movement started to happen, I was sort of stunned by it, not because I thought, oh, heavens, sexual assault doesn't happen here. We all know the statistics. I know that on my campus, at least one out of four of my female students is at risk for sexual assault. I know that in the United States of America, every 2 minutes there's a sexual assault, and frequently that assault, I don't know what the exact statistics are, is a child. So it's not that I'm naive about that, but I was still shocked by how deeply entrenched patriarchy is still in the U.S. with its rape culture. And I was also shocked that women who grew up in this country, you know, which has had a sexual revolution, where you have strong feminist movements in the plural, young women who have a great sense of self, you know, and who believe that they're equal to men, that even women as strong and independent as those felt so intimidated for so many years before they could out some of these abusers. And, you know, there was this whole culture of silence and complicity around them. So the thing is, patriarchy can't just be chipped away by looking at individual men and saying, oh, these are bad apples. Patriarchy can only be chipped away if one sort of struggles with the whole structure of it. And
systemic.
How do you do that? Systemic. Absolutely.
So are you optimistic?
Does it matter? We still have to do what's right, Kyle.
Right.
Because if we just sort of sit around saying, well, nothing will come of this, then we wouldn't do anything in the world. So, you know, you have to do your bit or what you think is your bit. And beyond optimism and pessimism, of course, if we study history, we know everything changed. Patriarchy was not always there and it won't always be there. The question is, what's the price that we will have to pay in the interim?
Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Asma Barlas is a professor of politics at Ithaca College, and she was a guest lecturer on the University of Arkansas campus earlier this month. She's the author of the book, Believing Women in Islam, Unreading Patriarchal Interpretations of the Quran, and co-author of Believing Women in Islam, A Brief Introduction, both published by the University of Texas Press. This is Ozarks at Large.